Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, Executive Director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, who talks about growing concern over the constitutionality of federal forces' suppression of racial justice protesters in Portland, Oregon. Amber Kelly, Assistant Professor of Social Work at Quinnipiac University, and Barbara Fair, a retired social worker, who discuss the role of social workers in addressing police reform and community safety. And Peter Hepburn of the Eviction Lab at Princeton University, who examines the possible policy solutions to the looming eviction crisis, where as many as 28 million people across the U.S. could lose their homes. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
With the global coronavirus pandemic dramatically reducing the demand for energy, plunging the price of fossil fuels, oil states in the Middle East are struggling. According to The Economist, no Arab state other than Qatar is making a profit pumping out oil at the current price of $41 a barrel. In May, Algeria moved to slash its national budget in half to deal with lower oil revenues. Iraq's new prime minister, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, is cutting government salaries. Kuwait's deficit now equals 40% of its economy. The global glut of crude oil and increased competition from clean energy sources means oil is predicted to remain at record low prices for years to come. No region of the world faces a more serious energy crisis than the Middle East and North Africa. Saudi Arabia's oil revenue has fallen by 50% since 2012. In an attempt to balance its books, the Saudi monarchy has suspended a cost-of-living allowance for state workers, raised gas prices, and tripled its sales tax. Public anger is growing. Saudis gripe about the new taxes, which fall most heavily on the poor. Some ask, why is Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia's de facto leader, not taxing the rich? Why doesn't he sell his yacht and live like us? New Delhi activist Natasha Narwal, who led protests against India's divisive Citizenship Amendment Act, won release from prison in May. But the activist, who proclaimed her innocence, quickly faced new criminal charges that included murder, terrorism, and fomenting religious violence, and was returned to her cell. The New York Times reports the Hindu nationalist regime of Prime Minister Narendra Modi has detained government critics, using sedition laws to target Muslim activists opposed to the citizenship law, which many say legalizes blatant discrimination against followers of Islam. India's coronavirus restrictions, some of which are still in effect, have blocked pathways to justice for the dissidents, say lawyers and rights activists. With courts closed for weeks, lawyers have struggled to file bail applications, and meeting privately with their clients in prison has been nearly impossible. A recent report by the Delhi Minorities Commission accused officials of Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party of inciting violent attacks on protesters and supporting a pogrom against Muslims. Senate Democrats are asking a top bank regulator at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency to explain how the agency handled several investigations into redlining and discrimination against African Americans in the U.S. banking industry. Senators demanded answers after ProPublica and the Capital Forum published a story revealing that six lending discrimination probes were dropped under the Trump regime. According to the report, the OCC abandoned investigations into the Bank of America and five other lenders suspected of bias. The Bank of America probe was reportedly shelved after corporate lawyers pushed back on examiners. In early 2018, bank examiners began an inquiry, but it was shut down in September 2018 with no penalties imposed against Bank of America. The Trump administration shelved similar inquiries against banks in Chicago, Michigan, Colorado, and Pennsylvania. Discrimination in mortgage lending was banned more than 50 years ago under the Fair Housing Act of 1968, but the home ownership rate for Black Americans is 44%, compared with 74% for white Americans, according to the most recent census data. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As racial justice protests entered a third month across the U.S., Portland, Oregon has become ground zero for President Trump's policy of deploying federal paramilitary forces to cities to enact his Law and Order re-election campaign strategy. These federal agents, from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Customs and Border Protection, and the Department of Homeland Security, have indiscriminately shot tear gas and impact munitions at mostly peaceful protesters, journalists, and legal observers. Clad in camouflage without identifying insignia, these forces have used unmarked vehicles to abduct protesters off the street without using legally recognized arrest protocols. The presence of these federal forces has provoked an increase in the number of protesters in the streets around Portland's federal courthouse, who are demanding a withdrawal of what they view as an invading army. Mothers, veterans, teachers, doctors, nurses, lawyers, and dads with leaf blowers pushing out clouds of tear gas have coordinated their mutual defense in what can only be described as a grassroots rebellion against illegitimate authoritarian power. Trump has since deployed federal law enforcement agents to Kansas City, Seattle, and Chicago, and has pledged to send these forces to other cities across the U.S., including New York, Detroit, and Philadelphia. Your reporter spoke with Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, who talks about growing concern over the constitutionality of these federal agents' actions and the organized resistance to their presence in Portland.
Well, I think when we look at what the Trump administration is doing in response to this massive movement across the United States, it is actually backfiring spectacularly on the Trump administration. But that's not to say that it is harmless and without extreme danger and cost. It is shocking. It is an outrageous violation of fundamental constitutional rights. But it is at the same time really important to recognize that, quite frankly, they're just not succeeding in repressing this movement. And that was obviously the goal.
What can your organization, the Lawyers Guild, the ACLU, some of the other civil liberties legal organizations do to intervene here? Is there anything that could be done in the short term?
Yes. I mean, there are, and we are working on these matters, litigation to get injunctions against police tactics, against police conduct. I mean, this is where it's inadequate just to go to a court and say, oh, we think there's a general violation of the First Amendment or the Fourth Amendment. You have to be able to point out with particularity what's happening. So for those legal groups that actually are on the ground, I mean, we are always on the streets. We are, you know, always out with people and demonstrating. And that's true of a lot of civil rights lawyers who are really, on the front lines. It's not just about being there for the show of being there. It's because we believe in the issues, but also because it is the one way that we can actually observe what the police are doing with specificity to be able to effectively litigate. And that's what we've historically done at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, is to be able to see these are the tactics they're using, and we need to be able to get an order that they can't do a particular tactic, that they can't trap and detain people, that they can't use less lethal weapons, that they can't use indiscriminate weapons against people engaged in First Amendment activity, that they can't engage in mass arrests, that they have to, they can't violate particularized probable cause. But this deployment, I believe, is unconstitutional and illegal. To the extent the Department of Homeland Security has authority to protect a federal building, that doesn't extend to just marching down municipal streets and arresting people and brutalizing people. They don't have that authority. It extends well beyond what their statutory authority is to protect a federal building.
Mara, I did want to talk about the propaganda and the intent here on the part of Trump and Barr. It seems pretty clear that President Trump wants to use this deployment of federal forces to cities like Portland to get some videotape of protesters battling police, fires being set, other chaos in the streets that are broadcast on right-wing networks like Fox News to drive home his election year message that the left in this country is threatening the suburbs with chaos. I mean, that seems to be verbatim what Trump is trying to get across. What should protest organizers be careful with in terms of not falling in a trap of the intentions of the Trump regime and their propaganda strategy?
The Trump administration certainly wants to be able to have images of conflagration that, as you said, can be spun on Fox News and try and threaten people that, you know, their neighborhoods are going to burn down if they don't have the law and order president instituting his form of martial law on the streets of America. That said, the reality that's happening here is, well, that historically has worked. I mean, every time we've had a resurgence of a social justice movement, you always have this propaganda coming from local officials, from police chiefs, from whoever is speaking out to say, well, you know, we welcome the good First Amendment protesters, but then there are going to be these other people, and that's why we have to have police repression, basically, because we have to, you know, save your neighborhood from burning. And that's a common theme. But the thing that's happening this time is that people are really seeing that the vast amount of damage and harm and bodily injury and really horrific attacks, that it's coming from the police. That's why more and more people are coming out, and coming out from all walks of life, because they're really seeing, I think, for some parts of the nation's populace for the first time, they're seeing a level of police abuse that they haven't seen before or haven't understood before. And so that's what's really turning the tide, is the police violence, which is the vast amount of violence that's occurring here, is being exposed. And people, instead of being afraid and chilled, are saying that they're going to stand up and fight back against it.
That was Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, Executive Director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. For more analysis and commentary on the Trump regime's use of federal forces to suppress peaceful racial justice protesters, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The nationwide uprising against police violence targeting communities of color, which began after the police murder of George Floyd on Memorial Day, has made many demands, including a call for defunding police departments. Many Black Lives Matter activists are demanding that millions of dollars from municipal and state police budgets, including lucrative overtime pay, be diverted to fund much-needed mental, physical, and emotional health services. One of the professions that's been highlighted in this discussion is that of social workers. Debate rages about whether social workers should operate within or separate from police departments. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with two Connecticut social workers who've been active in the Black Lives Matter protests. We hear first from Amber Kelly, assistant professor of social work at Quinnipiac University, who shares her perspective on the role of social workers in policing reform.
So my perspective is that policing in our country, they have a really specific type of training. And their training is very different than the ways that we train our social workers in this country. And many of the reasons that police get called are due to systems of inequities, are due to poverty, are due to violence in families, are due to a lot of reasons that where social workers could have a positive impact. And at the same time, my view is that social workers should not be working in police departments, because of the difference in training, as well as the negative relationship many communities have with police departments. And for that reason, I believe that social workers should always continue to act as an agency, as an organization, as providers outside of police departments in the United States.
Some politician, maybe it was Biden, recently said that his daughter is a social worker, and he wouldn't want her going alone to deal with a domestic dispute, which, of course, can turn lethal. Your thoughts, Amber Kelly?
I think there's a place for advocates and social workers and a crisis response team who's trained in de-escalation crisis response showing up. And if someone there is truly in danger, that's when you call the police, right? If that's a need in the situation. If it's not in the need in the situation, then you have people trained in de-escalation crisis response and family violence who can intervene, and who can come up with a plan for that family, for the survivors of the violence, that makes sense for them. So I know of situations where it was a life and death moment, and in that life and death moment, it was a police officer who saved a survivor's life. 2 hours later, that survivor needs other resources, needs other people, right? But in that life and death moment, a police officer was necessary to keep her alive long enough where she can make different choices, can access resources that she needs or they need. So sure, there are certainly times in life and death moments where you need somebody else. At the same time, because police officers are not trained in de-escalation, or trained well at least in de-escalation, they often don't know how to work with survivors in a way that's empowering for them, that's not one more method of disempowerment for them, not one more person in a power and control relationship, which is just like the relationship that they're trying to survive, right? And that has a very different impact when you are calling for help and someone shows up who has more tools at their disposal beyond arrest and beyond law and order in the situation. There are many times where someone calls the police in a situation of family violence where they're just wanting to de-escalate the situation and put in a pause, and that's the only thing they can think to do. How great would it be if they could call for crisis response and de-escalation rather than having police show up, where oftentimes an arrest is made that nobody anticipated or wanted. They just wanted help with a really terrible situation that was happening in the moment.
That was social work professor Amber Kelly. Barbara Fair is a retired licensed clinical social worker and a decades-long social and racial justice activist in Connecticut. Barbara, I'm really interested in your take on police, also known as school resource officers, or SROs, in the public schools.
I mean, the two other kids, wasn't our kids, were going around shooting up schools and stuff. We never had all this security and zero tolerance. All this came out of other kids, white kids, doing these things. And so, like any law that they pass, black and brown kids are going to be the ones who are going to suffer the most from the policy. And that's how all this got started anyway, with, you know, treating our kids like they're criminals. When I talk about defunding police, it's about taking some of those millions of dollars that they're spending on them and instead do things that really work for our kids. Because if you look at it, police can't solve the real problems in our community, like homelessness, addiction, mental illness, people coming out of prison, broken homes, all of those things, intergenerational trauma. Police can't do anything for all of that. But yet we rely on them. I don't know. I think we're just so conditioned that police is to resolve for everything that we rely on them for these things, that they can't do anything but arrest people. That's all they can do at the end of the day. And that's not helping. It's just like we put the SROs in the schools. They were supposed to be a support for our kids. And what happened is the juvenile justice system blew up as a result of having SROs in our school, because SROs, instead of helping our kids, were criminalizing their behavior and sending them into the system. So that's the main reason we don't need that. And when they talk about having social workers working with police, I don't think that's a good idea, mainly because I think just like a good person that goes into the police department, after you get in there, then you start adapting to their culture, consciously or subconsciously, you adapt to their culture. And their culture is not about caring and helping people in our community. In our community, the police is about enforcing the law. In our communities. In white communities, they may be different. They may be about protecting and serving, but that's not here in our community. So we don't need them working with the police department, because I think the best social workers can get in there and working with police side by side, they're going to adopt that culture and they're no longer going to be of service to our children.
That was retired social worker and community activist Barbara Fair, preceded by Amber Kelly, assistant professor of social work at Quinnipiac University. Find more perspectives on policing reform and the role of social workers in addressing community safety by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. America is facing a looming and devastating eviction crisis linked to the coronavirus pandemic and the resulting economic decline that brought record unemployment. On July 24th, the federal moratorium on evictions in properties with federally backed mortgages and for tenants who receive government-assisted housing expired. Under the CARES Act, the moratorium covered some 12.3 million rental units nationwide. At the same time, city and statewide eviction moratoriums are also expiring, which has already triggered a flood of new eviction proceedings in more than 30 states. While the current national unemployment rate is 11.1%, the extra $600 in federal weekly unemployment benefits are set to end on July 31st. Although Congress is now attempting to negotiate an extension of eviction protections and a continuation of some level of unemployment support, both President Trump and the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate have opposed the $3 trillion HEROES Act legislation approved by the House in mid-May. Your reporter spoke with Peter Hepburn, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Rutgers University, Newark, and Research Fellow with the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. Here he examines the possible policy solutions to the pending evictions of as many as 28 million people across the U.S. that would deepen the nation's already dire economic crisis and cause severe personal hardship.
This is both potentially an economic catastrophe, a serious public health concern, and then a personal hardship on a scale that's really hard to imagine. To take the first as an economic issue, the current expansion of unemployment insurance, the additional $600 a week that many people who have lost their jobs are now receiving, is almost certainly the thing that is keeping rent paid for many households. That additional money exceeds income replacement for lower income individuals, so people who are more likely to be renters than homeowners. This is what's keeping the rent paid and is holding off at least part of this wave of evictions. So starting to roll that back is going to mean less rent being paid, which means more landlords who are having difficulty paying their mortgages, which could lead to a wave of foreclosures, which in turn triggers its own financial crisis that would quite possibly make the Great Recession look quite minor by comparison. As a public health concern, the issue is really that you have the potential of many households losing their homes in relatively short order. Many of those households will then end up moving in with relatives into sort of these what's called doubled up housing, in which they are living in more densely packed households in which social distancing is functionally impossible. We know that the coronavirus spreads extremely well in those sorts of circumstances. And then the more extreme outcome would be homelessness. And to put people at risk of homelessness right now is, you know, displays a callous disregard for human life and also increases the risk of this virus spreading more rampantly. And then on the individual scale, eviction has been linked to a whole host of negative repercussions. This hurts your credit. It hurts your ability to find future housing. It tends to lead to job loss. It leads to material hardship, financial hardship, greater levels of stress, depression, and suicidal ideation. I mean, the list goes on here. It's a severe hardship for individuals and for their families. And we know that that doesn't affect just the individuals, the leaseholders that are being evicted, but it also affects their kids. And we know that kids are a risk factor for eviction, and those kids are going to suffer as a result of this.
The House of Representatives actually passed an extension of the federal moratorium, and the Senate has not yet come up with a package that would cover evictions. It's possible that new legislation may not be viable in the coming weeks, but from your perspective, what could or should the federal government be doing to try to stem this avalanche of evictions that, as you just said, won't just affect the individual families, it'll affect the entire economy and may bring us to a point of collapse we haven't seen since the Great Depression.
So I think there are three key priorities. The first is an extension and ideally an expansion of the federal eviction moratorium. I think we saw Larry Kudlow signaling willingness on the part of the White House to extend that moratorium this weekend. We haven't seen that translate into any sort of concrete legislative action at this point. The second point is maintaining some sort of expansion of unemployment insurance. As I said, the additional money that is flowing to unemployed individuals and their families right now is absolutely critical for keeping rent paid. And then the third thing that is going to be important is going to be some sort of federal emergency rental assistance. There have been city and county level efforts to provide this sort of emergency rental assistance, and those have been noble efforts, but they are simply incommensurate to the scale of the problem. There has to be a major investment at the federal level to provide some rental assistance at this point. The HEROES Act called for $100 billion in emergency rental assistance, and I think the negotiations over the coming weeks to get the Republican proposal and the Democratic proposal on the same page, we certainly hope that emergency rental assistance is part of that. That's critical because these eviction moratoriums do not amount to a cancellation of rent. What they entail is that if rent is not paid this month or next month and the moratorium goes until September, then on October 1st, you owe all of that back rent. And that's going to be a major hurdle for a lot of households to catch up on the rent that they may have missed because of the economic hardship brought on by the pandemic.
That was Peter Hepburn, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Rutgers University, Newark, and Research Fellow with the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. Learn more about the looming eviction crisis and the work being done at the Eviction Lab by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WERU in Blue Hill, Maine, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.